This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Brisky,
featuring former FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreek.
Jennifer Crumbly going to be spending some time in prison, still awaiting the actual sentencing, but she's been found guilty of involuntary manslaughter in regards to her son's school shooting, which took out four of his classmates in 2021. It's a case that likely is going to have repercussions for quite some time on other cases, maybe even past cases. Joining me to discuss, attorney Eric Faddis. I guess that is the question. How far-reaching is this going to be? Is this as precedent-setting as I think a lot of us have been saying or thinking as of right now?
I still think it's a huge deal, Tony. I think it's going to have far-reaching implications in terms of who is prosecuted, in terms of whether we reopen past cases and try to find additional folks who might be held responsible, like the parents. And so I'll really be interested to see the ripple effects of this outcome and how it plays out for the justices.
Now, obviously, there's been a lot of cases in the past where parents have been civilly gone after and many of them found guilty in several of those cases. But just that, going back and reopening past cases, I can think of several where, it's similar to this, where the gun was provided by a parent or it was just not locked up in the house. The kid got a hold of it and, the child was prosecuted, but the parents, they stood on the sidelines and watched it all happen. How far back does something like this go? I mean, statute of limitations varies from state to state, but there's not a lot of limits on homicide in most cases. I mean, how far back do you think this could go and should it go back super far? Is this something that really should be looked at going forward as kind of a precedent on that direction?
Yeah, like you said, usually the bar for reopening cases, the prohibition against it is that there's been a statute of limitations that's run and you can't charge somebody. But like you said, with homicide cases, that's not really how things are. And So, gosh, could they go back to, the Parkland shooting? Could they go back to the Columbine shooting in Colorado in the 90s? Yeah. It's a bit unclear how far back they are going to go. And what is that going to mean? It's going to unearth a ton of trauma. Is it going to bring additional closure? Perhaps. I don't know. But I think that's a question a lot of people are thinking about.
It's something that is certainly, going to be far reaching going forward. What kind of chances do you think Jennifer Crumbly has on appeal? Because obviously it's going to go there next. The attorney for Jennifer Crumbly, I've heard so many varying opinions on this from some pretty good defense attorneys in our country. And I was surprised. Some saying she was great. They liked her, even though obviously it didn't turn out well, but they liked her demeanor. Others very much saying this was an utter train wreck. And maybe could be gone back onto appeal of inadequate representation. Do you think there's any chance of going back on that? Or what sort of grounds do you think they may have on bringing this up on appeal?
I didn't see the whole trial, but I saw a lot of it. And at least in my review, I didn't see any glaring grounds for appeal. Mm-hmm. And especially one particular ground is when the defendant wants to testify, but the attorney advises them not to. Mm-hmm. And then the person's convicted and says on appeal, hey, I wanted to get my story out there. Jennifer Crumbly doesn't have that option because she testified. And so one potential ground of appeal would be kind of a legal ground stating that the causation issue and the parents are just so far removed. It's such an attenuated chain between the parents and these actual school shootings that perhaps there's some traction there on appeal on kind of a legal basis.
Yeah, it was an interesting one. When I look back, because I watched a lot of the testimony of Jennifer Crumbly on cross and also direct, and it... I kind of felt odd about some of the direct because it felt more like it was cross. It felt like some of the questions that her own attorney was bringing her was incriminating her or making her not look the greatest in front of that jury than even some of the cross did. But as you stated, no glaring issues from your perspective as an attorney.
Yeah, no glaring issues that stand out. And, that's the thing. But when a defendant takes the stand, especially in a murder case, there are risks that abound, that there is so much that can go wrong, that there are things that happen in the middle of that examination, even if it's from your own attorney, that might go south. And that happened to some degree while Jennifer was on the stand.
Yeah. Obviously, there's another trial coming up. It is her husband that's going to be on trial. Obviously, the first case here is usually the stronger case. They're going to bring him up next. What is this a slam dunk thing going forward? What kind of repercussions is this one going to have onto him when he takes the, or if he takes the stand or just gets into that courtroom?
I think there are multiple considerations at play. So I think it's not looking good for James Crumbly, the father. But one thing we did hear from the foreperson and Jennifer Crumbly's jury is that they essentially blame Jennifer in part because she was the last adult to handle the firearm before Ethan got a hold of it. That's not the case with James, but James was at the gun store and actually purchased the firearm. So that makes it even more problematic for him in my appraisal. And so I think things are not looking good for James right now.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one to watch and see where it all goes. Certainly lots of questions to see how this affects. Do you see it having an impact, honestly, on society at all in terms of seeing a slowdown in school shootings or anything? Or is this kind of one of those things where, you know, the people who are responsible are already being responsible? The good parents are already being good parents. You know, it's kind of one of those things where if the parents are already troubled, the kids are already troubled, it is what it is. It's not necessarily going to legislation or this being a precedent making anybody go, oh, I better not buy my disturbed son a gun. The folks who already think that's a good idea probably still think that, in my estimation. What are your thoughts?
You know, I was thinking about that exact same question. And I was thinking, you know, what if there are some parents who are in a different part of the country who are struggling, that they're struggling resource-wise. They don't have a lot of information. They've got a troubled teen who they're trying to just raise and deal with. You know, are those folks even going to hear about this? Mm-hmm. And if so, is it going to have some material change in their behavior because this happened? Or are they just so overwhelmed and, you know, in a position where they can't do a whole lot and they're not going to change a whole lot based on this verdict? I worry that's what's going to happen. It's not going to have a huge impact on, you know, a huge parenting change in America. I'm just not confident that it will.
Yeah.
Sick of the ads?
We are too.
Start listening with no commercials now and get access to all of our episodes in advance of everyone else.
Become a True Crime Today Premium Plus subscriber on Apple Podcasts.
Search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts or go to our podcast page and sign up now.
True Crime Today Premium Plus.
Sign up now.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.